On this week's 51%, we have a story about the state of women coaches at colleges.
The statistic of women only coaching 43% of women's college sports teams, the fact that that hasn't budged in the last decade, that it's stayed right around there, is really what's most baffling.
Hear from a police officer about what she calls being black in blue and find out how the Army is incorporating mindfulness. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Title IX was enacted in 1972 with the intent of eliminating gender discrimination from educational institutions. But it turns out there may have been some unintended consequences, resulting in a decline of women coaches at colleges around the country. That's according to a recent report from Reveal, the radio show from the Center for Investigative Reporting, NPRX. Lauren Schiller, host of Inflection Point, invited Annie Brown, who reported the story, to share what she learned. Brown starts with an explanation of Title IX.
We all kind of have this understanding that Title IX is synonymous with athletics. But actually, in the language of the law, it doesn't mention sports at all. It actually just prohibits discrimination based on sex in any educational setting. And so that was then sort of applied to sports a few years after the passage of the law.
You follow a specific story out of Iowa following women coaches who were affected by the change in the law. And I'd like to start with Christine Grant, who was the athletic director for women's sports there in the 70s for several decades. What did she tell you about what the situation for women coaches was like before Title IX?
Right. Christine Grant is this amazing woman. She's actually Scottish and came over to learn how to be a sports administrator in the United States. And she started out at Iowa as the field hockey coach. And at that time, she told me that, you know, women's sports were like a club, you know. You had to pay out of pocket to participate in them. There weren't uniforms. You didn't have money to travel. She said they slept on the gym floor when they would travel, and she drove them around in her car. And so when Title IX happened, a lot of those things that are directly related to resources changed in a major way. But at that time, when women's sports were not funded, only women coached the women's teams. So across the country, 90% of women's sports teams at that time were coached by women. And what she says is that, you know, they weren't being paid. So the only people who were interested in doing this were doing it out of the kindness of their hearts, and that was women.
So what happened when money started coming in?
Yeah, so when money started coming in, so the situation before Title IX is that women's sports really exist in their own department across the country. Most schools have a separate department for women athletics, and that department is run by a female athletic director. Then after Title IX, they have to receive comparable resources to the men's programs. And what happens is that a lot of schools choose to merge those departments, to take the women's department and bring it into the men's department. And Iowa was one of the only places in the country that actually kept a separate athletic department for the women. And that was run by Christine Grant. And in these new athletic departments, what happens is a bunch of new teams are made because now women's sports have to be comparable to men's. So they add a bunch of women's teams. And when they do that, the male athletic director hired just over and above women, he hired men. And so we see this massive drop in the percentage of women coaching women's sports. It drops to 58% in like half a decade.
And this is a national trend?
So nationally we're talking about. But Iowa was kind of this exception because Iowa kept a separate athletic department for their women, and they kept Christine Grant in charge of that athletic department. She had control over who was hired for these coaching positions, who got fired, how they were evaluated, how the money was used. And Iowa was really seen as one of these bastions for gender equality. And they were really good. I think under Christine Grant, they won 27 Big Ten titles in 27 years.
So ultimately, Christine Grant decided to retire, and a male athletic director came to replace her. So at that time, were those athletic departments then combined, the male and female athletic departments, when she left?
So actually, a male didn't come in to take over for her. Basically, they just brought the women's athletic department and merged it under the male athletic director. And Christine says, you know, at the time that it was like, of course, she felt like it was 2000. You know, it was like we're sort of beyond this point where they had to really protect the women's teams and the women's coaches. And the athletic director at the time, a man named Bob Bowlesby, she really believed that he had had the best interest of the women's teams in mind.
So then what happened? Because you talk about a coach, Tracy Griesbaum, who was the women's field hockey coach. She had an incredibly winning team.
Yeah, so in 2006, a new athletic director took over for Bob Bowlesby, and his name is Gary Barda. And that's really when things started to shift at Iowa in terms of how many women were coaching women's sports. Under Christine Grant, women coached an average of 80% of the teams during her tenure. This is a super high average when it comes to, like, when we look nationally over that same period, we're looking at like 50%, 48%. But then when this athletic director, Gary Barda, took over, within his time there, that number dropped down to 50%. So Gary Barda has been criticized for this reduction in the proportion of women's teams coached by women. And he's also been criticized for the recent firing of the field hockey coach, Tracy Griesbaum, who you were referring to. She was a very successful coach at Iowa, had four Big Ten titles in her name, had been head coach there for 14 years. And she was fired in the fall of 2014 for allegations of being verbally abusive. And an internal investigation at the University of Iowa actually found that she committed no policy violations, but the administration felt like they had to protect their students and decided to fire her. And in response to this firing, there was just an upheaval on Iowa's campus. The whole field hockey team rallied behind Tracy, signed an open letter to the university saying, "Reinstate our coach." Alumni showed up to games with signs that said, "We're embarrassed by Gary Barda." And there was really this sense that something wasn't quite right, that people didn't believe that Tracy could have been verbally abusive in this way, and that something was amiss here.
And you actually went out and tried to find someone to say something that conformed with the allegations that were made against her. How did that go?
Yeah, so I reached out to 60 of her players, and I heard back from 24 of them. And really, none of the women that I talked to before we published the story had anything negative to say about her at all. And really just glowing things, just that she was the best coach they ever had. Many of her players have become coaches, just inspired by Tracy herself. Actually, after we published, one person has come forward and didn't want to go on the record, but confirmed some of the allegations, said that she had, you know, yelled at players, that she had, that they believed that it was possible for her to have called a player stupid, and some other of the allegations. They said that they were in therapy in response to her. And so we were hoping to really get a sense of whether these allegations are true. And as a reporter, I can't really say for sure whether or not Tracy Griesbaum was abusive to her players. I just don't know. What I do know is I talked to 24 of her players, and they said that she wasn't. And I talked to one of her players, and they said that she was.
So, but it seems like the way that your story unfolds, it's tying Tracy Griesbaum's firing back to the merging of the athletic departments, and that the way that the athletic department that is being run at Iowa is not necessarily thinking about who is going to be the best coach for the women's team, and that perhaps they're using these allegations as a way to move people off of their staff that they don't necessarily want there. That was my takeaway from the story.
Sure, yeah.
How did you come to that conclusion?
Of course, yeah. So Tracy's actually the fifth female coach to be forced out in 6 years. And this was really seen as a major trend at Iowa by the critics of the administration. And so part of the claims that Tracy has made in a lawsuit against the university is that she was fired in retaliation for speaking up for the department, that she was sort of known as one of the most vocal female coaches who were critics of Gary Barda. And I talked to the other coaches who were fired, who said that, you know, Tracy stood up for all of us, that there was that, you know, whenever they had something that they needed to bring up, that they could go to Tracy and she would bring it up with the administration. And so Tracy claims that she was fired in retaliation, that it wasn't about these abuse claims. And you know, you have to sort of to unpack this idea of whether or not a coach is fired for verbal abuse. You know, one thing that's helpful is just thinking about, like, what if a man was engaging in the same kinds of behaviors, which we don't have any actual evidence of Tracy doing, but let's just say that that's that all those allegations are true. And a question that a number of her supporters say is, you know, would a man have been fired for those same things? And I think that the sense is that men coaches are allowed to be tougher on their players than women coaches are. But when I looked nationally for this, you know, I ended up looking for as many women as I could find who filed a similar retaliation claim against their university, female coaches or sports administrators who filed similar complaints. And basically what these lawsuits say is that the woman was a vocal critic of the athletic department in terms of gender equality. And in response to the woman being so vocal, the university decides to demote her or to fire her. And I actually found 38 of these lawsuits across the country in the last decade. And I didn't really go looking for this trend, but I noticed as I started talking to these women that a number of them had very similar experiences to Tracy, that they were accused of being verbally abusive before they were fired, or when they claimed, no, you retaliated against me, the department said, no, the real reason you were fired is actually because we think that you were abusive to our players. And so actually 13 of those 38 coaches had allegations of mistreating their players lodged against them somewhere in the process of their firing. And so it seems like this is either a trend in female coaches being abusive and being fired for such, or a way that that universities can use these allegations to remove a coach in retaliation.
What I just keep being slightly baffled by is another thing that you uncovered, which is that when the women coaches were replaced by male coaches, that those male coaches got paid more.
Right.
That's the part I keep getting hung up on, that because if you could have really great performance, and this sounds so cynical, but if you could have really great performance and not have to pay top dollar for it, mm-hmm. why wouldn't you
right.
stick with that? Because the teams are not doing as well now, right?
Yeah. So the five women who have been forced out of the University of Iowa Athletic Department, including Tracy, two of them have been replaced with men. And those men have been paid an average of 25% more than their female predecessors. And then for the three he replaced with other women, those women were paid 13% less than their predecessors. And so, you know, the university, when I've asked them this question, and they have pointed to the experience of the candidate, to the peer comparison within the Big Ten. But as a reader, it's hard to, you know, not see that as a significant trend.
Well, you went in and you spoke directly with Gary Barta. Mm-hmm. How many times did you have an audience with him?
Just once.
Once.
Yeah.
So what I found interesting as a listener to your conversation is that when you went in, it was very jocular. Hey, how you doing? And then as you started asking the harder questions, he started sounding much more defensive and mm-hmm. kind of towing the party line.
Yeah.
And one of the areas that you went into was what we talked about earlier, that Iowa had this great record of women coaches for women's teams
right.
in the 86-90 percentile, and that it's now down to what is basically reflective of the rest of the country.
Sure.
And his argument was, hey, we're still doing great. We're at like 50-50, which is
right.
maybe even better than
right.
the national average.
It is, yeah.
So what was your take on that?
Yeah, it is. It's true. I mean, Iowa still is ahead of the national average after this drop. You know, I think that's I challenged him in just saying, you know, when you compare it to the national thing, yeah, it looks pretty good. But when you compare it to how it's been in previous decades since the departments were merged after Christine Grant retired, it doesn't make sense. You know, I think that was a thing that we were trying to investigate in this story, in this report, was really why has this continued? You know, like in 1970, 1975, 1977, these numbers are dropping. Women coaches are being replaced with men. Men are getting hired over women. It makes some sense. It's like the 70s, you know, like this was it's still wrong, but like it's not so surprising. What feels surprising is that it's still happening today, and that number, you know, that the statistic of women only coaching 43% of women's college sports teams, the fact that that hasn't budged in the last decade, that it's stayed right around there, is really what's most baffling. One of the things that it can feel like that we're sort of like at half and half of like, now we have half women coaching women's sports, we have half men coaching women's sports. That's only in women's sports. If you look at sports as a whole, women are not coaching half of sports because they're not coaching half of the men's sports. Because while men have increased in how much in the proportion that they're coaching women's sports over the last four decades, women have remained only 3% of the coaches on men's teams. So it can give kind of a false sense that things are like right, you know, smack dab in the middle, but that's just on women's teams.
Thanks, Annie. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
That was Annie Brown talking about her report, A Man's Game on Reveal, from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. She was speaking with Lauren Schiller, host of Inflection Point, produced at KALW. Sergeant Lakeisha Phelps is a police officer in Nashua, New Hampshire. She's one of two black cops on a force of more than 170 that serves the increasingly multiracial city. Emily Corwin of the New England News Collaborative met with Phelps to hear about what it feels like to be, as Phelps put it, black in blue.
Sergeant Phelps. Hi, Nicole. I can remember when I first got hired, I had a little blue sports car, and one of the troopers would stop me like once every other night. I'm like, how do you not know my car by now? I worked midnight shift, so I would be coming to work at 11 o'clock. He would be in the turnaround, and I would see him come out, and I would just start pulling over. Can I attribute it to me being black and in the wrong place at the wrong time? Probably, because I stick out like a sore thumb.
Which is address correct?
My name is Sergeant Lakeisha Phelps. I am currently a street supervisor for the Uniform Field Operations Bureau. I've been here for 19 years, so long time. You get it from both ends. I get it from my law enforcement friends that saying, I don't get this whole Black Lives Matter thing. Why does race matter? You're sitting there saying, what if I am a part of that movement? You're not asking me, you don't care to ask because you're not seeing me. And I'll get from actual family members, cops f-ing suck, not you, auntie. And it's sort of like, but I'm here.
What began as a routine traffic stop turned deadly Wednesday. Philando Castile has died.
That week, it just came to a head because so much stuff had happened.
Over the shooting death of Alton Sterling by two Baton Rouge police officers.
Snipers opened fire on police who were on duty at a Black
My deputy chief Matter came to me and said, hey, would you participate in this community conversation?
I have something to say.
It gave people in the community the opportunity to see what police officers thought.
I just wanted to know, like, how do you guys feel and take it? Like, when you hear about the young black males getting shot, obviously, by the police, like, how do you guys take it? Like, what happens in the police office? Like, what do you guys talk about?
Well, I'll tell you, I guess.
The whole time that I was there, I'm like, Lord, I need to keep my mouth closed because I know something wrong is going to come out.
I get very defensive of police officers because I am one. That's what I can relate to. That's who I am. That's, you know, what I can relate to. I say, hold on, don't judge the cop on what happened yet until you know what happened. And don't take
When I say it was overwhelming, I can still replay parts of actually getting up and speaking. I woke up, I never felt such hopelessness, despair. I felt miserable. I looked at my 2-year-old son and I said, how can I explain to him that people that dress like me, because he knows that I'm a cop, he comes to the station all the time, people that are dressed like me are killing people that look like you. Not that they're not killing white people or Asians, but this is a personal, now I'm speaking as a person, not as a cop. That was my personal assessment. What do I say to a 2-year-old black kid? How do I explain that to him? Fast forward until officers getting ambushed and killed. My 14-year-old white daughter came downstairs and said, you going to work today? I said, yep. How can you go to work when you know that there are people that look like you killing people that are dressed like you? This was a choice that I made to put this uniform on and protect people that look like you, no matter what. I impressed myself by keeping a lot of negativity out of that conversation because I wanted to take a stance of Black power and you guys need to recognize Black people. But I know that that's not the case with some of my coworkers, because it's not that they don't recognize Black people. They're just uninformed. And I wouldn't believe racism existed in a sense if it never happened to me. It needs to be talked about now.
That was Sergeant Lakeisha Phelps in a piece produced by Emily Corwin with the New England News Collaborative. A battalion of Army paratroopers is embracing a training technique that might seem more appropriate for a yoga studio, a psychology lab, or even on the sidelines of an NFL game. It's known as the human dimension, and it could be the future of the Army. Jay Price reports from Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Psychologist Megan Hallbrook watches half a dozen young men lying in a row, broiling in the sun and trying to slow their breathing to help focus their thoughts.
We have some iPads set up where they can look at their heart rate. We can talk through some of the breathing exercises we've coached them on.
It could almost be a scene from a local community center course on mindfulness, except for the specific source of their stress. The kicking, hard-to-aim machine guns they're partly draped over, trying to hit enough targets to qualify with the weapon.
Even if they're just laying prone here, not firing, but they're going through the motions in their head, whenever they actually fire, it's like they've already done it before.
The Army has developed a new framework, a kind of philosophical shift in how it wants to train soldiers. It's called the human dimension. The idea is to create soldiers who can be trained more quickly and adapt faster to the increasing complexity of war.
What we are building right now inherently is an agile and adaptive leader.
Lieutenant Phil Kennery commands the 2nd Battalion of the 504th Parachute Infantry Regiment.
By getting a paratrooper to fully focus and be able to zone in on what he's supposed to do, he now can make clear decisions.
In other words, he says, to help soldiers tune out distractions and focus more on not just what to think, but the best way to think. He's working with the scientists of the Army's Research Center in Natick, Massachusetts. Retired Army combat veteran Rick Haddad helps run the collaboration. He says for 7 months now, the scientists have been flying to Fort Bragg regularly, doing things like observing parachute training from inside aircraft.
When he did studies in the past, he didn't get to know the soldiers personally. He didn't get to see all the things behind the scenes that were happening that could be having effect on the soldier cognitively or physically and socially.
Haddad says Kennery's unit is the first to build the human dimension approach into the way it operates. Some of the psychological techniques, though, like breathing and visualization, have been used for years by special operations units and for centuries as part of traditions like Zen Buddhism. Sports psychologist Michael Gervais works with the NFL's Seattle Seahawks, the U.S. Women's Olympic Indoor Volleyball Squad, and other high-profile sports teams.
Mindfulness was a practice that many of the samurai warriors were attracted to become more aware of their thoughts, aware of their actions, aware of their emotions, aware of their physiological state.
There are lots of parallels between cutting-edge sports psychology and what the Army's trying to do. One common thread is the belief that being humiliated for a mistake can undermine performance.
What we really need in those moments when we make a mistake is course correction, not disappointment and shame. And when we value the human being and what they do, rather than get frustrated with the mistakes that we make, it becomes an incredible accelerant to performance.
In other words, maybe that iconic military scene, the angry sergeant chewing out a young private, is about to become less common. Lieutenant Colonel Kennery says his sergeants and corporals are beginning to think about why a junior soldier might be failing and focusing on fixing the cause rather than yelling and forcing him to endlessly repeat the task.
Instead of saying, "You did that wrong," they're actually catching it before it happens, and they grab him and say, "Hey, just take a deep breath. You know what you're doing."
All right, here's your different, Hayes.
Behind the firing range, under a stand of longleaf pines, Hallbrook shows a group of soldiers how to use an iPad with an ear clip sensor to monitor and control their stress level.
So this is, we call this M-Wave. It's just biofeedback. So all you
Among them is 20-year-old PFC Alex Jungles from Illinois.
I did try a couple of the methods they taught us, like belly breathing. And it does help. You're able to have a nice light trigger squeeze, so you're more accurate.
Already, the scientists have begun working with 4 other battalions, and they hope to begin spreading what they learn across even more of the Army next year. I'm Jay Price, reporting.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1423.